Welcome to the program for Thursday, July 14th, 2011, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We start off, as we always do, in the 3 o'clock hour on Thursday with industry chatter. My guest today is Jerry Edgerton. He's president of the Federal Group at Blue Ridge Networks. Jerry, great to see you. Thanks for coming in today.
Francis, it's nice to be with you. What a beautiful day.
I'm sorry we couldn't do the show outside today.
Wouldn't that be great?
I tried to set that up, but we couldn't pull that off. I'm glad to have you here. Let's begin with a description of your company and what you do for federal clients.
Oh, absolutely. Blue Ridge Networks has been around for a while. It's a company that has its legacy primarily in dealing in the intelligence community and has been a successful participant in that community for many years. And we've recently restructured the company and are focusing the company now on the emerging or the continuing to emerge cyber threats and bringing some of the technology and capabilities that we've developed over the last 15 years to that marketplace. We started out primarily in the hardware, firmware world, and now have moved to the software virtual world and are bringing out these capabilities now on a much larger scale.
Is it fair to say that somebody that's been in the cybersecurity business, whether it's your company or a person, for 15 years has seen almost the entire history of at least awareness of cybersecurity?
I think that this is such an emerging area and such a growth area that it's hard to say that you've seen everything. You're only minutes away from your next hack, or if in the world that we're living in now, and that's as a result of just the total emergence of networking capabilities and everything becoming totally reliant on cyber.
Is because of the nature of the evolution of the threats and so on, and when we'll talk later about how it looks, at least to me, like cybersecurity is kind of a tree where the trunk grew for a while and then the branches have gone in a million different directions. Is history or a historical perspective still important when it comes to dealing with some of these threats?
Well, yeah, because there's still some common elements in cybersecurity, certainly the human aspect of this and, you know, the trusted aspect of that, of who do you trust and when do you trust them and so forth, is the common element that has not changed.
Yeah, okay. We talked a little bit before we went on the air about that idea, the human aspect. One of the things that I wonder if you think it's getting enough attention is that very thing, both the intentional and unintentional threats that are coming from inside organizations.
Well, The classic trade-off in cybersecurity is ease of convenience versus the inconvenience of having a secure system. And we've seen recent examples now of ease of convenience has allowed things like WikiLeaks to occur. Okay, and so you still have the trusted human element of it, but the whole concept of ease of use has overshadowed. We think of the simplicity now of the iPad. And how we now are exchanging tremendous amounts of data, and it's a simple process, but it's fundamentally lacks security. I won't say it's insecure, but it certainly lacks security.
Yeah.
It's a significant trade-off.
That trusted human element, is that being treated, do you think, appropriately? Because it sounds like it maybe should be treated as a cybersecurity, as an element of cybersecurity and risk assessment. And I imagine the risk assessment part is there, especially in the intelligence and defense communities. But I wonder if the cybersecurity element is being considered enough.
Well, we could go down a couple of paths on that. Certainly the concept of stovepiping and isolation and so forth has been an element that's contributed not only security but cybersecurity. And then you get into sort of the emergence of today's the new employee, the world of tweet and Twitter, the world of now it's okay to publish anything on Facebook, that it's okay to put anything on YouTube. And so where's the ethical boundary that you get into in this? So, you know, how do you teach people ethics and what role or how do you presume that people lack? So ultimately cybersecurity has to constrain some of the freedoms that we come to come to learn about and enjoy. So.
I guess federal agencies too aren't the only ones that are trying to figure out that delineation, trying to figure out that balance of who has what and what is that line, and educating the people that need to be educated when it comes to these ethics issues?
Well, everybody's installed the same systems on the same platforms and same hardware, so everybody's dealing with the same ethical issues, you know, at the human level.
Mm-hmm. What's different about cybersecurity ethically, though, than the typical operations that we've observed in the past, and the ethics that apply there about what you share and who you share it with and who has access and who doesn't?
Well, I don't think anything's changed in that particular. If you go back, you know, we deal in the human space with trust, and, mm-hmm. and you know, relationships are built on trust. And so we have to have some degree of trust and cannot depend on the systems around us to instill that.
Mm-hmm. So if the principles are the same, then it is a matter of just educating a new generation of people and educating them appropriately for a new generation of technology. Is that fair to say?
And then going up against, you know, the control aspect of it. You know, what kind of controls do you put in and so forth, you know, to the point that you're not invading privacy or private space.
Mm-hmm. Are the agencies having a hard time figuring that out, do you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the rules are disparate. Each agency has a different interpretation. One of the pressures of the last decade was the whole concept of FISMA, okay, where we would basically analyze what we thought was your information security status and do it against a set of guidelines. And yet, compliance with FISMA did not necessarily mean that you were secure. So we're again, filling in the box to some degree.
Yeah. When you look at some of the provisions that are being talked about for a potential FISMA 2, are you seeing that emphasis? The sponsors claim that they want to get away from the box checking exercise that the CIOs and CISOs have talked about a lot. Do you see that as the appropriate goal, and do you see them getting to a continuous monitoring solution through some of the things that are being proposed on the Hill right now?
There are a variety of things being proposed on the Hill. I'm not sure that there's any single solution, but FISMA 2 certainly has the same vulnerabilities as FISMA 1 had. And we're back to an issue, and I think it's a universal issue, of accountability, integrity and accountability. You know, who's accountable for security? And it's an elusive thing, because when there are issues and incidents and breaches and so forth, it becomes one of those things where there's a lot of finger pointing and not a lot of resolution, not a lot of clarity in the
mm-hmm.
process.
And I imagine then it's hard for an agency to try to attach accountability to that when it is so difficult to pin down even source and the perpetrator and so on.
The gate is open and,
yeah.
and the criminal has gone home.
Uh-huh.
Right? And that's generally what's happened. You know, we go back to the early days of the lost. The lost laptop at VA was sort of the first awareness that we got of this, and that was the tip of the iceberg to a great degree. You know, mm-hmm. how do you teach somebody not to leave their laptop in the car?
Yeah. Well, I want to talk some more about events like the laptop mm-hmm. loss and that kind of thing when we come back from the break. Jerry Edgerton's my guest. He's president of the Federal Group at Blue Ridge Networks. My guest on Industry Chatter on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Jerry Edgerton of Blue Ridge Networks is my guest on Industry Chatter today. You mentioned the VA laptop episode from a couple of years back, 2006 or 7, I believe it was, as being the first really widespread awareness of the potential risks of exposure of data and cybersecurity threats. Are we hearing more about cybersecurity threats today because there are more threats, or are we hearing about them because agencies and private companies and other organizations are more willing to talk about the threats and the exposures and so on than they were in the past, do you think?
I think we're definitely hearing about – I think more threats are occurring. And you go back to sort of what – why, okay? And the reason is they're more attack surfaces, if you want to look at it from that perspective. Everybody's, I think, sitting around here has some kind of smartphone, which mm-hmm. creates an attack surface. If you now look at the number of devices, how many PCs do you have at home, you know, and not only in the office and the other places that you're exposed to it. So we've created an environment now. Look at the number of things that are occurring in the cloud, the current cloud computing world of Amazon and Google. So just the possibilities are there, and the attack surfaces have been just exposed. So now we probably are having more attacks than we can even determine.
Mm-hmm. Are we aware of all of the attacks that are happening, do you think? Are we even able to really quantify the threat?
No. Remember, the current process and system is we know that we've been attacked after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've not been able to anticipate them, and it depends on the you could almost anticipate some of the denial of service attacks because of something that occurred in the media, some public outcry of some sort. But the more insidious attacks, we don't know until they have occurred, and then we attempt to remediate them or fix them after the fact.
Yeah. The reason that I ask that is when I was on vacation last week, I watched some crime show on cable TV, and a law enforcement officer, it didn't have anything to do with cybersecurity, but he said the perfect crime is so perfect, nobody knows it ever happened. And that clicked with me when we started to talk about cybersecurity today. It occurs to me that that's the same, maybe the same thing is the case in the realm of cybersecurity. The perfect attack is so perfect that nobody knows that it happened.
Well, there's also the globalization element here, okay, that now we have empowered the rest of, when I say we, that's probably pretty much the United States technology. We've empowered the rest of the world, and we empowered them at a different point in time. You know, we evolved through copper wire in the ground, through fiber and so forth, and immediately now you've created global attack surfaces in emerging companies with all kinds of smartphones, wireless, you know, think of the Arab Spring and so forth and the impacts of that. No way for those things to have occurred in the past. So my point is that we've created an environment now that may be to the point of out of control.
Mm-hmm. One of the areas that may be more out of control than others is something that we touched on briefly, and I'd like to explore a little bit more, and that is the unintentional versus intentional threats. Secretary Lynn was speaking today about 24,000 files that were removed from DoD networks as a result of the Buckshot Yankee exposure. I think we're just now getting a handle, even a year or so later, on how severe that was, and that was the result of an accident, essentially. Somebody unintentionally put a thumb drive into a DoD computer, didn't know what was on the thumb drive, and here we are dealing with this still at this point in time. Do we have a handle yet on how to educate people to not do certain things, or is that even possible given that we're dealing with human beings?
I think it goes back to what extent do you want to put controls in, because some of the mechanisms that are being designed now preclude you from exporting anything. Okay, that, remember, today we can download and print virtually anything, you know, mm-hmm. if it's compatible, and yet these kinds of exposures have occurred because somebody introduced some kind of malware and then allowed that to operate in such a way that it exported files, and we didn't even know it occurred. So we've got to educate people, but there's a degree of control that's got to come about now, and inconvenience.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I wanted to go next, is that's going to make people's jobs more difficult at a time when people are already saying, my job's plenty difficult as it mm-hmm. is. Talk about that inconvenience factor a little bit and what people are maybe should or will have to put up with in the pursuit of trying to make things more secure.
Well, we can go to the concept of passwords. When's the last time you changed your password?
On my network here, I have to change it every 30 days.
Yeah.
Passwords I don't have to change, not quite that often.
So we started out with passwords, okay? And then we came up with mechanisms that forced you to change your password. And you know, each time it becomes even more convenient. And any time you can, you'll bypass the process to make sure that you don't have to use that password. And I'm guilty of using the same password over and over because of my failing memory problems. But it's
you're not the only one.
That's an example of the inconvenience factor. Now then we put some rigorous rules on top of that, that you're not allowed to go into cyberspace that you used to go into. What do you do now? You know, we can go literally any place at any time, unrestricted. Now we start constraining it and we're putting barriers up and so forth, and really putting to some degree automating those. I think you have to put some machine interface into automating these processes by which critical data is accessed and exported.
And don't you think it's reasonable to be able to make that case that certain things are sufficiently important that they deserve that kind of thing? I mean, whether I can conveniently log into my profile on ESPN.com or something is relatively unimportant in the grand scheme of things. But whether somebody can log into the Department of Defense network or log a piece of equipment onto it is certainly important enough to warrant some level of inconvenience, I would think.
I agree with you that there have to be degrees of value, and the question then becomes, who's the judge or the jury in that process? Okay, and I was looking at a couple of the websites in anticipation of this, of some of the hacker organizations, and they basically, why do you do this? And they have as part of their blog, because we can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of hard to defend against.
Yeah. It's that old, that's where the money is argument.
Why do you rob banks?
Yeah.
Because that's where the money is.
Well, let's talk more about degrees of value when we come back, because that's a concept that I don't think a lot of people have explored yet. My guest is Jerry Edgerton. He's president of the Federal Group at Blue Ridge Networks on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Jerry Edgerton's my guest. He's the president of the Federal Group at Blue Ridge Networks, and we're on Industry Chatter in this hour. You mentioned degrees of value and assigning degrees of value to information as it's prioritized and determined how secure it needs to be. Has that concept really been explored a lot yet in government, do you think?
I don't think it has, because I'm thinking of my personal experiences, and I look at my favorite bookmarks and all that, and they all have equal value, mm-hmm. whether I'm going into a banking application or just a news application or whatever. So right now we treat them on our iPhone or iPad or personal computer with equal value.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, if you get in and say, how do you value your financial information? Okay, whether it's your stockbroker or you're trying to pay your credit card bill or whatever the deal is relative to the financial information, that information has one value to you and it has another value to the supplier of that information, and they may or may not be the same.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this ultimately gets down in the way the cybersecurity problems are resolved. And probably in government, too, will be economics, okay? Nobody's figured out a way, because of the defocused activities, as to how to make a lot of money in security. It's necessary, but everybody can charge a little bit for it, but it's not become part of the economic equation.
Mm-hmm.
But that's changing, okay? As you lose data, as you lose the type of data, whether it's proprietary information, whether it's some kind of secret information or life-threatening information, whether it's financial information that can be exploited, then this data is beginning to have real value. And then you're beginning to see things in the environment now that are challenging who has responsibility for that data.
Hmm.
There are a series of lawsuits out there now as a result of loss of data. And is the bank responsible? Is the provider of the network responsible? Who's really responsible for it? So you're going to begin to get some accountability now. The other aspect is, if data has value, can you charge more for it?
Mm-hmm.
And we're beginning to see things like, as an internet service provider, when you provide a more secure service you know, and can you charge for it? And what are the warranties around that? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen one major telecom company who said, I'm thinking about providing a much more secure service and charging for it. So beginning to see the economic aspects come into it. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, I guess from a government perspective, the government has much valuable data, and they consider it valuable. The users ultimately have to be we ultimately have to figure out a way that there's economic reward for doing it. It won't be legislated. It'll be economic reward.
Mm-hmm. An interesting perspective. As you're talking there, I thought of a qualifying question that either I ingeniously developed on my own or I copied from somebody, and I don't know which it is. But tell me if this makes sense to you. The qualifying question maybe should be, what will it take to repair the damage if this data is exposed? Is that a reasonable way that once you try to assign a value there, that then you can just put them in order and figure out how to prioritize what should be how secure?
Wow, that's a tough question. In the sense that some data, okay, structured data is of ultimate value. You know, mm-hmm. I guess nuclear codes or the key codes to bank vaults or whatever that is, mm-hmm. and so forth, things that you could really cause economic disruption and physical disruption. Then that has infinite value.
Right.
Okay. So you would assign values to that that are just sort of, inviolate. There's no way that can be compromised.
So, but if you assign the infinity value to that one, then that would be at the top of the list. It sounds to me like it potentially could be as simple as attaching a value, putting that next to a name in a cell on a spreadsheet, and then just sorting them by value. And deciding that, okay, this information that we have would be the most expensive if we had to repair damage done by this data being lost. That's what I'm getting at. Does that make sense, or is that too simplistic?
It's fairly, I won't say it's simplistic. I will say it's overly complicated.
Okay.
Simplistic, overly complicated.
Okay.
To administer. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
How would you do that? There's a degree of the owner of the data. I'll go back to the sort of the kinds of the owner of the data and the user of the data, the perspectives on that. And, if you're a government worker sitting there and you're doing payroll for a highly classified agency, that's a different value of data than it is for what your person sitting next door may be working on as an analyst of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting way. So I think we're back into some kind of physical control, some kind of basic ability to screen and train and assure the integrity of the human interface.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think ultimately, or what groups of people, will make those decisions about degrees of value? Or who should, maybe?
Well, now you're up against the ACLU and everything else in terms of the privacy issues, because I remember, 20 years ago, there was the concept of the one humongous database, that we were going to have, and we were going to know everything about everybody with the ability to do sort of unstructured access to that data. And then eventually the idea died.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It was too expensive to implement and so forth. But you're beginning to see concepts of where you have profiles. I look at Amazon and how many things that touches now, from business to actually a presence in the federal space now, mm-hmm. from the point of view of cloud computing. So the problem is just geometric now in terms of the problems or the possibilities. So I think my Amazon data is probably okay. I've certainly got some protected pieces of that data. Maybe mm-hmm. that's where we go with this thing, is that there are ways to protect, based on your own perspectives, the value of the data inside the framework that you're working in.
But what happens in a federal space when we have a piece of information, piece of data that you and I both work with, and my perception of how it should be protected is different than your perception of it?
Then it's up to some systems administrator to value that. There are mechanisms now for allowing access to, as part of, we started going down the password and the password changing part. There are different ways now of authentication. Okay. And part of the authentication process is what data are you allowed to see. So some of that is taking place now. So there's a rules body somewhere that said, because of your job, your role, responsibility, your title, whatever, you have access to certain amounts of data and certain profiles and programs and so forth. And so there are some rules out there, okay? And then maybe that's another way of attempting to control and change and manage the different values of information.
So the framework that we're using now for how we allow people access may be the same framework that's used in the future or something similar for the data access?
Yes, it could be. I mean, because you've got everybody doesn't have access to everything, so there are degrees in that. And maybe it's electronic stove piping.
Just what we need, more stove piping. We're going to continue our conversation with Jerry Edgerton, the president of the Federal Group at Blue Ridge Networks, when In Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Jerry Edgerton of Blue Ridge Networks is my guest. I'm curious to know your thoughts about some points of view on posture that agencies find themselves in. First of all, what I call the triage versus preventative posture. Are you getting a sense that some of the attacks, some of the threats are finally starting to bounce off the armor rather than agencies constantly being in a posture of we've got to fix whatever the latest disaster is?
Yeah, I think, it depends on the agency, but you're beginning to see an awareness, okay? And you're beginning to see some steps taken to that, but there's still usually some bell ringing event that causes this awareness. I said I was going to make the point earlier, just because you're compliant with FSMA and basically because you've gone through a certification process doesn't mean you're secure. So there is a sense of false awareness out there that you may have done the things to check the box, but there's a requirement for constant vigilance in terms of this. You know, how do you basically make sure that that you are not vulnerable? Have you done everything that's possible? Are you using best practices? Are you learning and observing? Are you stove piped within an agency in such a way that you don't know what's going on around? So, but there is a beginning awareness of it. We talked about sort of money being set aside. There have been several attempts at funding cybersecurity initiatives, but it tends to get lost in the process and consumed by other needs of maintaining the systems and the status quo to some degree.
My sense, though, is that the CIOs, at least at the agencies, have been beating the drum on this for a long time. They've been saying, hey, wait a minute, on FSMA, for example. They've been voicing what you said about FSMA for a long time. I'm doing all the boxes, but I can't go to the secretary and say for sure that we're secure. So that awareness has been around for a long time, and yet we see incidents that you go, well, didn't you learn the lesson from Agency X who had this problem 6 months or a year ago?
Weren't you paying attention?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So what's the disconnect there, do you think?
Well, I think the CIO, I think it goes back to the fact that the role of an agency and the automation that's taken place in how the agency does its mission, it has not quite caught up with what the overall mission is. If you're sending out Social Security checks, that's sort of your mission versus protecting the infrastructure that does that. So I use that as an example. And so to some degree, you're always protecting and maintaining the system to send out the checks versus making sure that you're not vulnerable to any kind of hacking or attacking.
So we're not to the point then, it sounds like, where that protection is integrated as part of the mission.
It's not one of the three legs of the stool.
Right. And I don't mean, I'm just using it because it's an example that you raised up, and I don't have any knowledge of what's going on specifically at Social Security, but just as an example, let's say, speculatively, that rather than the idea is we want to make sure that these citizens are served, there's kind of a still a stovepiping, to use the word we've used a couple of times. And in this example, at least, the idea of protecting that network that cranks out those checks is not connected to the actual distribution of the checks. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
But it's that, but also just when you look at the amount of money it takes to maintain an IT infrastructure and to keep it running and fast and doing all the things it should, that consumes a major portion of the budget that's mm-hmm. associated with this. So now you got an unfunded mandate like a FISMA that says, okay, go do all of these things, and oh, by the way, you know, make sure everything is secure.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's there a lot of competition for the funds to manage these systems and processes.
I just want to be clear again, too, that I don't mean to pick on Social Security.
No, I use that
I don't,
as an example.
Yeah, but yeah, because yeah. that's a very basic government function,
yeah.
and that operation is there. I don't want people to think that I have some kind of information about what's going on at Social Security.
You'll be happy to get your check from them.
Well, at some point in time, I hope to, and we also have a lot of terrific listeners at Social Security, and I don't want them to think I'm pointing the finger at them unjustifiedly. Jerry Edgerton's my guest. He's president of the Federal Group at Blue Ridge Networks. My guest on Industry Chatter on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Jerry Edgerton of Blue Ridge Networks is my guest, and part of the fun of this for me, Jerry, is talking to people not just about what's going on in federal government, and I've enjoyed that conversation. We were talking during the break about your passion for aviation. Where did that come from?
I think I came back from the fact that after World War II, my father basically decided he wanted to take up flying and went out and flew a Piper Cub around and got his license, and somehow that gene stuck. So both of my brothers are aviators, and my son is a professional aviator in the area. He flies a helicopter for Fairfax County.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
So he's living the dream. He got out of technology, and he's living the dream.
That's very cool.
So
as we cycle through all of the things that we've talked about on cybersecurity, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I think if you visualize it, it looks like a tree where there's the trunk and then the branches go in a million different directions. Do you think that we'll see more of that kind of diffusion of specialties and sub areas of expertise in cybersecurity? Or are we due for maybe kind of a convergence of some of these things when it comes to focusing on threats and so forth?
I attended a luncheon last week or week before last where the former director of DNI spoke, and he had his predictions on cybersecurity and the results. And sort of he had this prediction that there will be a catastrophic event. In classic government style, it will lead to overreaction.
Mm-hmm.
In classic style, it will lead to some kind of legislation that will not solve the problem and so forth. But in answer, we're going to keep trying what I call point solutions.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that you've got cybersecurity ads running while we're not on the air. I got three or four different ads today in my email trying to sell me some kind of malware protection and so forth. So it's just there's just no end to it.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it's going to take some economic discipline by people who value the data to force some controls and inconvenience in the process. So I think we've gone full cycle here now. But and whether it's a banking transaction or whether it's a government valued transaction, to provide the inconvenience, to provide the necessary controls on it, and basically minimize the number of pinpoint apps. I finally took all of my personal computers and cleaned them all off, okay, and started from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I lost track of how many different malware programs I had, and antivirus programs and so forth. And once you do that, you have a wonderful PC that's not spending all of its time trying to figure out, can I search all the files and figure out what I don't know
or
you don't know what you don't know.
Well, I was going to go there next because you used that term during one of the breaks, and I wanted to make sure we talked about that a little bit before we get ready to wrap up here in just a moment. How do you find out what you don't know? How do you know what you don't know, or is that what's keeping not just the federal government, but private sector companies and so on, in this kind of defensive posture that we talked about a little bit earlier?
Well, the current remediation efforts today for any kind of cyber attack or hack is, once you find out it's occurred, then you attempt to identify it and come up with some kind of remediation activity, okay? Or somebody identifying the signatures, putting out antivirus software, anti-malware, and so forth. So you really don't know what you don't know, okay? So one of the ways and one of the things that I'll go back and get my little ad in here now. One of the things that we do at Blue Ridge Networks is we have a way of making sure that you don't get infiltrated and you don't, and you cannot export. So we basically isolate and limit your flexibility as to what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can still have full function of your PC or device for those lesser valued, that lesser valued data. But for that high-value data, there's some mechanisms by which you can limit the access and limit the vulnerabilities associated with that.
I have a whole lot more questions to talk about with you and topics I'd like to cover, and I have no time to do it. But I really appreciate being here today.
It's
been
great
fun.
Being here. This is fun.